know there are questions about yesterday's announcement on the transgender policy by the president. There will be no modifications to the current policy until the president's direction has been received by the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary has issued implementation guidance. In the meantime, we will continue to treat all of our personnel with respect. As importantly, given the current fight and the challenges we face, we will remain focused on accomplishing our assigned missions.
The Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph Dunford, now clarifying President Trump's ban on transgender troops serving in the military. Transgender service members will be allowed to serve until the White House sends the Defense Department new guidelines and rules. Meanwhile, the Justice Department is arguing that gays are not protected by civil rights law. DOJ lawyers weighed in on a case this week of a skydiving instructor who says he was fired for being gay. So what does the law actually say about who and who is not protected from discrimination? I'm joined now by Adam Romero. He teaches law and sexuality at UCLA. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Well, tell us more about this particular case. What is the skydiving instructor alleging?
Well, Donald Zarda was a skydiving instructor for a company called Altitude Express. And in 2010, he was working with a client, and he told her that he was gay, I think in an effort to make her feel more comfortable being so closely tethered to him. After that, the...
Literally tethered, because they were falling out of an airplane together.
Correct. And then after that, the woman's boyfriend complained to the company, and the company fired Donald Zarda.
Expressly because he's gay?
Well, that's the claims in this case.
That's what he says.
Exactly.
And the company, what does it say?
That Title VII, the federal civil rights statute, does not prohibit sexual orientation discrimination, and therefore his claims do not lie under federal law.
Well, I guess explicitly it doesn't, because when you look at the law, Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, it says you cannot discriminate in the workplace based on, quote, race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. Nothing explicit there about sexual orientation.
That's correct. Title VII does not expressly include sexual orientation in the text of the statute, but it does include, as you mentioned, sex. And Congress, when it enacted the Civil Rights Act, did not define the term sex. Instead, it left to the courts the job of deciding what qualifies as sex discrimination and what does not qualify as sex discrimination.
And how have the courts interpreted that?
Well, for many years, the courts held that sex prohibition in Title VII does not cover sexual orientation discrimination. However, in 1989, the United States Supreme Court held in a case called Pricewaterhouse versus Hopkins that Title VII prohibits employers from making employment decisions based on stereotypical notions of gender. For example, an employer cannot not promote a woman because she doesn't act in a stereotypically feminine way, or an employer cannot fire a man because he's not, quote-unquote, masculine enough. But increasingly over the last few years, courts have been recognizing that it's practically impossible to distinguish between gender stereotyping claims and sexual orientation discrimination claims. When you take a step back, sexual orientation is by definition sex-based, and that's because someone is understood to be gay if he is attracted to someone of the same sex or she is attracted to someone of the same sex. Similarly, someone is understood to be straight because she is attracted to someone of a different sex or he is attracted to someone of a different sex. So sexual orientation, by definition, takes sex into account.
And how does religion play into all of this?
Well, interestingly, the United States Supreme Court is going to hear arguments this fall in a case called Masterpiece Cake Shop, in which the court will be deciding whether a baker who refused to provide a wedding cake to a same-sex couple is protected by the First Amendment for that decision. If the courts hold that Title VII prohibits sexual orientation discrimination as a form of sex discrimination, then the question will be whether an employer with a religious objection to gay and lesbian people or same-sex marriage is entitled to constitutional protections to commit that discrimination. What happens in the cake shop case will, of course, inform what happens in other civil rights areas as well, including employment.
Okay. So the Justice Department filed a brief, an amicus brief in this case, correct?
Correct.
On the side of the employer. And meanwhile, within the same government, federal government, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC, filed a brief on the other side.
Well, the EEOC and DOJ have taken contradictory positions in this case. The briefs that they have filed will, of course, only inform what the court does, and it's ultimately up to the court to decide what Title VII does and does not prohibit.
Why is this? Has this become a big case in the legal world that people are looking at this in terms of whether or not it could go to the Supreme Court or, you know, make a definitive statement and ruling on gay rights?
This is a huge case. This area of law is evolving. And recently this year, the Seventh Circuit United States Court of Appeals held that Title VII's sex discrimination prohibition does prohibit sexual orientation discrimination. At the same time, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, a different court, came to a contradictory decision that Title VII does not prohibit sexual orientation. So all eyes are on the Second Circuit right now to see, will it agree with the 7th Circuit Court of Appeals or will it agree with the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals?
And when will we know?
Well, the court has scheduled arguments for early fall, and I expect a decision probably within a few months or maybe 6 months. It's hard to predict. At the same time, the plaintiff in the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals case, where the court held that sexual orientation discrimination is not prohibited, will be petitioning to the United States Supreme Court to decide this issue.
Is it just a coincidence that this brief was filed in the same week as Donald Trump announced his transgender service member ban, do you think?
I certainly can't speculate as to the timing, though it is certainly remarkable that so much has happened on the LGBT front in the last couple of days. I would note, of course, that these decisions that are coming from the Trump administration have substantial and significant impacts on the LGBT community and potentially could have life-altering ramifications, for example, for transgender people in the military.
Adam Romero teaches law and sexuality at the UCLA School of Law. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
All right, what do you think? Is sex discrimination the same as discrimination based on sexual orientation? Should gay people receive the same protections against job discrimination? You can tell us what you think on Facebook or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. All right, senators are still debating various versions of a new health care bill. It's a far cry from just 2 years ago when Republican senators passed a full-on Obamacare repeal. The GOP's continued inability to make good on its promise to repeal Obamacare has frustrated some of the party's big financial donors. And joining us now to talk about how big donors are viewing what's happening on Capitol Hill is reporter Ken Vogel. He covers lobbying and money in politics for the New York Times. Hi, Ken.
Hey, great to be with you.
Great to have you. Well, what is the mood among the big backers, people like the Koch brothers, Sheldon Adelson? They really helped Republicans gain control of all three chambers. So now what do they think?
Well, they're not pleased, but let's not forget that they did not start in a great place with Trump either. In fact, a lot of them, including the Koch brothers who you mentioned, did not support Donald Trump's campaign. And he got a lot less big money spending through super PACs and other sort of unlimited money vehicles than Mitt Romney 4 years earlier. So there were not super high expectations. That said, a lot of them did come to the table and sort of make the peace with Trump and even give to his inaugural campaign and, you know, try to weigh in and exert their influence to the extent that they had any with his administration, with his White House, on some of these key wish list items, including Obamacare repeal, including tax reform, that are going nowhere thus far.
Yeah. Well, and the beginning, or at least in the House version of the Obamacare repeal and replace, there are big tax breaks in it. And so were they in favor of that? And did they want to see that in the Senate version? And so far, nothing?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, that's high up on on most of these donors' agendas. But what they see is an inability of the administration and the White House to sort of advance any of these things. And, you know, frankly, some of them have deeper relationships, a lot deeper relationships with these congressional leaders, Mitch McConnell, namely, but also Speaker Paul Ryan. And they are increasingly concluding that the White House is the problem here, and the Trump folks are not sort of taking advantage of this moment, to the point where you have some donors who are threatening to boycott not just Trump and not to give big money to Trump or the vehicle supporting his agenda, but also threatening to withhold funds from some of the congressional Republican vehicle super PACs, the National Republican Congressional Committee, National Republican Senatorial Committee, unless there is some action on some of these fronts.
Well, it doesn't look like at this point there is going to be substantial replace and repeal of Obamacare. So are they going to follow through with their threats, or will they wait and see what happens with tax reform?
Yeah, I think tax reform was the one that they were most excited about, obviously. This is this is the holy grail of Republican policymaking. We haven't had a significant tax reform bill in decades, and the reason why is it's very difficult. And Republicans aren't even confident, congressional Republicans who I talk to aren't even confident that they'll get a budget, a spending bill, which is really the first step towards tax reform. You need to pass a budget to sort of get the legislative procedures that allow you to do a filibuster-proof tax reform bill, and there's some sense that might not happen, that first step.
And are they placing the blame on the White House or on the Senate Republicans, House Republicans? What?
I mean, there's certainly blame to go around, but again, the deep relationships in donor world on the Republican side are with these members of Congress and congressional leadership, particularly less of a deep relationship with the Trump folks. You see it in the Trump folks have this outside money vehicle. It's a 501c4 nonprofit group called America First Policies that was seeking to raise a lot of money to try to push the agenda through Congress. It famously aired an ad just briefly criticizing Dean Heller, the senator from Nevada, for his initial opposition, and continued opposition to repealing Obamacare. This group, my understanding is, my sources tell me, has not raised a lot of money, and you would think that if you had a lot of support from major donors for the president and his agenda, that this would be the type of thing that would manifest itself, and the support would manifest itself in big money going to this group, which would be able to exert pressure from the outside on some of these Republican members of Congress who are unwilling to go along with the agenda. That's the outside game. The inside game is equally deficient. The ability of Trump and even Mike Pence, who does have a relationship with a lot of these members of Congress, to bring them in and sort of bring them along with the agenda and get them to come and come on board and take some of these difficult votes, that's not happening either. So you're sort of struggling on both fronts, both the inside game and the outside game, both of which are sort of key to getting legislation through Congress.
Right. And then you have these other groups like Tea Party Patriots and Club for Growth, and they launched a website called Traitorous Republicans, where they're targeting senators like Lisa Murkowski, who voted against this latest provision in the Senate. And so how effective can they be in launching a website like this and sort of calling out these senators? I mean, Murkowski's not up for re-election next year.
Yeah, I mean, they could certainly weaken these senators, but, you know, to what end? I mean, Dean Heller, if you're going to primary Dean Heller, you're making that much more difficult for Republicans to maintain that seat in the general election. So I think some of the savvier donors and their representatives and some of the outside groups that have a track record of spending big money to try to pull the Republican Party to the right on the issues that they care about are a little bit leery about this. Club for Growth has always been somewhat of an outlier in that they've been more aggressive in launching these campaigns that sort of traditional Republicans don't necessarily see as having the party's best interest at heart. But as to whether there will be a widespread effort like that, I think they would get a lot of pushback from Republican leaders if that was their goal.
So if they do indeed pull funding from future campaigns, where are they going to put their money?
Yeah, that's the other thing, is that, you know, this is long sort of this is long pattern of threats like this, and, you know, big donors feeling disenchanted by either the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, and, you know, talking about either withholding their money or trying to use their money to pull the party to whatever position they like. But in the end, it's a two-party system, and if you want to play in politics, these are your two choices. So you got to decide if you're, you know, if even if you're disenchanted with your own party, it's still the calculus usually winds up with it still being your party, and they end up coming around. Oftentimes, where it is problematic for the party is when the money doesn't come in early enough to help them build the infrastructure that is necessary to really, you know, do the tactics and implement the playbook that is seen as having the best chance of victory, and the money comes in late. And Sheldon Adelson, the Las Vegas casino mogul who you mentioned, has a reputation for doing this, writing a big check late when it's difficult to really take advantage of the money and use it effectively. So even if these threats only result in the checks coming in later, that still could have an impact.
Ken Vogel covers lobbying and money in politics for the New York Times. Thanks, Ken.
Yeah, thank you.
Coming up, the president touts a $10 billion factory the Chinese company Foxconn says it will build in Wisconsin. But looking at Foxconn's track record, it's not at all clear the plans will be realized. That story is next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. A new $10 billion factory in Wisconsin making flat screens and other electronics. That's the plan announced at the White House yesterday by the chairman of Foxconn, the Taiwanese company that makes iPhones and iPads for Apple. President Trump was happy.
The construction of this facility represents the return of LCD, electronics, and electronic manufacturing to the United States, the country that we love. That's where we want our jobs. To make such an incredible investment, Chairman Goh put his faith and confidence in the future of the American economy. In other words, if I didn't get elected, he definitely would not be spending $10 billion.
But Foxconn has a habit of making big announcements and not following through. Will Oremus writes about technology for Slate. Hey, Will.
Hi, Madeline.
The factory is going to be, coincidentally, in House Speaker Paul Ryan's district in Wisconsin. What are the plans, on paper at least?
The plan is that Foxconn says it's going to spend $10 billion to build this plant. It'll employ 3,000 workers building LCD monitors. And eventually, the idea is that it could employ as many as 13,000 people. That's not counting the 16,000-odd construction jobs that will be involved in building the facility. This is a big coup for not only for President Trump, but for Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker and for House Speaker Paul Ryan. It's in his district in southeastern Wisconsin.
Yeah. Well, the state of Wisconsin, though, is having to pay a lot to make this happen. They're giving apparently $3 billion or so in tax breaks and subsidies. Is that worth it?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. So that's right. They're offering $3 billion in subsidies to get this $10 billion investment from Foxconn. Now, that might sound at first glance like a pretty good deal. On the other hand, there are a lot of reasons to be skeptical of that. One thing that people have been quick to point out is when you look at the number of jobs that are actually projected to be created, Wisconsin is offering, you know, something like $250,000 in subsidies for each job that's getting created. Now, the jobs themselves are paying about $55,000 a year. Is that worth it? Well, it's hard to say. I mean, there are obviously you can hope for spillover effects from the economic revitalization of a project like this, if indeed it comes to fruition. But there were some fun anecdotes, like somebody calculated that it would have actually been cheaper for Wisconsin to buy an iPhone for every man, woman, and child in the state.
But then they wouldn't get the job. So, you know, we mentioned that Foxconn does this a lot. They make these big splashy announcements about building factories, and then sometimes they don't pan out. How often does that happen?
Yeah, that's really the rub here. I mean, it's hard to know exactly how often it happens yet, because it's really been in the past 3 to 5 years that Foxconn has embarked on this spree of announcing huge projects in countries around the world, securing big concessions from the local and national governments that they're working with. And then, you know, the early returns suggest that these are not coming to fruition as announced. So they announced a big plant in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania in 2013. All the politicians involved got to take their victory laps and score their political points. The plant was never actually built. They ended up building a very small research facility. In Brazil in 2011, they announced that they would build a plant promising something like 100,000 jobs would be created. And as of 2015, apparently it employed about 3,000 people.
Hmm. And so what happens when people follow up with them and say, well, what happened to your big promise?
Well, I mean, you can argue that that probably should have been done a little more in this process of securing this facility for Wisconsin, because, you know, Wisconsin is going to these great lengths to secure a facility. And, the math sort of works out if everything happens just as Foxconn says it will. That just seems highly unlikely. And not only because of the past broken promises, but also just because of the broader trends in manufacturing and the technology industry today. For Foxconn to make this kind of plant work out economically, it really needs, the idea behind bringing some of these jobs, manufacturing jobs, back to a place like the United States, where there are high labor costs, is that you can afford it because you employ fewer people and you're going to do more automation. So you're going to have robots doing a lot of the work, and that offsets some of the extra expenses of employing Americans versus, say, workers in China, where Foxconn pays less than half the promised salaries here. So it just seems, it's hard to know at this point, it just seems highly unlikely that everything will pan out the way Foxconn is promising.
Meanwhile, what is Apple saying about all of this?
Well, Apple has been mum. And the reason that Apple is implicated here is twofold. Number one, Foxconn is probably best known to Americans as the company that Apple has leaned on heavily over the years to manufacture its devices, including iPhones. There have been some reports over the years, some sort of muckraking journalistic reports about the poor working conditions at the factories in China. They're actually, I think these days, they're not particularly bad by local standards, but Apple has still taken flack for that. But the other reason that Apple is implicated here is because in the same breath, when he was mentioning that Foxconn would have an announcement, Donald Trump said in an interview with the Wall Street Journal that he had talked to Apple CEO Tim Cook, who was promising to build three big, beautiful factories in the United States. And that's a really interesting claim. I took a look at it in an article I wrote for Slate yesterday, because it would go against everything, all of Apple's strategy to this point. Apple basically doesn't build factories. It contracts with companies like Foxconn. So some people were wondering, is this really true? Is Apple really going to do this? Apple would not give me any comment. They haven't given any comment to anybody else. In essence, I think they're allowing Trump's claim to stand unchallenged, but a lot of people are very skeptical. And so some people even wondered, well, could this Foxconn plant be part of what Trump was referring to? I don't think so, because Foxconn is going to build, as you said, LCD monitors here. It's not going to be building Apple devices per se.
Hmm. Interesting. So even more questions. Willa Ramis, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Willa Ramis, he writes about technology for Slate, where you can check out his articles at slate.com. And we want to hear from you. What do you think about this whole plan of building a factory in the United States, Foxconn's plan? Do you think that it'll actually happen or not? Do you think it's a good idea? Do you think it's just pure politics? You can weigh in on Facebook at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, Shani Jardin is here to talk about hacking voting machines and why your Roomba is spying on you. Also, the guy who built an AI version of his dad.
to like do something that just had flashes of his fun, unpredictable, erudite personality.
Dadbot, coming up on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. DEF CON starts today, or DEF CON. I think you have to say it that way. That's one of the world's largest hacking conventions that takes place in Vegas every year. And new on the floor, the convention floor, something called Voting Village. That's a place where hackers can carry out attacks on various voting machines to show how vulnerable our elections are to hacking. Also, guess what? Your cute little Roomba? It's spying on you. It's Thursday. Time to talk web and tech news with Chenny Jardin, co-editor of BoingBoing.net and our regular web and tech and Roomba guru.
Before we started the news stuff, when I was on my way over here to KCRW, I was thinking, you know how you can uninstall apps from your phone and uninstall stuff off your PC or your Mac?
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be cool if we could just uninstall the entire government right now?
I want to uninstall my Roomba. Actually, I don't have a Roomba, but if I had one, I'd want to uninstall it.
Yeah, so Roomba is kind of where the Internet of Things meets creepy privacy security creep. iRobot, the company that made Roomba, is under fire today because people are realizing, through a series of news stories that hit the web this week, that the Roomba gathers all this kind of spatial information about the inside of your home.
So it's not just cleaning your floors.
Well, yeah, but I haven't even gotten to the really creepy part. So Roomba's bumping into things and gathering information to learn more intelligently about how to clean the, you know, cat hair and dust off your floor, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when it bumps into lots of toys, let's say in one room, that's probably your kid's room. Well, it's interesting to know now that Roomba's privacy policy is pretty vague on how they can use that information. And it's entirely possible that third-party companies, whether it be Apple, which actually has a pretty solid history with privacy and security, or the U.S. government, you know, they could access that data.
So the data being what? That they're mapping out your home?
Like this is the room your kid plays in. But also, yeah, mapping out your home, mapping out the times of day that it's active or inactive. Perhaps, now, here's the logic.
So for what purpose?
Well, here's the logic behind why both iRobot and the companies that it works with might need that. Let's say the Roomba and Amazon have a partnership to figure out, you know, when you might need to dust your table in the living room, or the carpet's getting stinky, or I don't know. You could imagine that there would be different product tie-ins, like that by gathering information about the physical space that you live in, companies could market things to you for that space. We already have those one-touch little Amazon buttons through both Amazon and Apple and other companies who have these intelligent learning listening devices in our home. Well, you know, these machines, you could look at it that they're spying on us and that they're going to send our information to Russian hackers or companies that have sloppy security or all of that is true. But then, like, there's an upside and a downside to every technology. And one of the most important things about the big scare about the Roomba leaking your physical data information to other parties, it's this. Everybody talking about this story wants a Roomba and would be like...
You mean we're actually advertising Roombas right now?
Well, like, I don't have one. And
it makes
me
not want to have one.
And the thing that happened to me, just like the Gizmodo writer said who was writing about this, this is actually the first time that I've thought about having one because that's sort of an impressive
level. It makes me want to just pick up a broom and do it the old-fashioned way.
But like, but I'm being a little flip here, but what I'm trying to get at is this. Everybody wants convenience more than they want privacy and security. Those are abstracts until you get hit. But everybody wants to do less work and to
have... Everyone wants to eat the apple. They don't want what follows.
But here's the other thing. Doesn't this sort of remind you, Madeline, of when the web first became a really rich commerce marketplace, and all of a sudden we had browsers putting cookies on our computers, mm-hmm. and we were thinking, oh, goodness, advertisers, heavens to Betsy, you know, we're clutching our little computer pearls. They're going to market things to us. Well, just as we were all freaked out about that with the World Wide Web and our web browsers, just remember, we're moving from the internet and from laptops and from keyboards and from screens into the internet of things. And this is the kind of conflict that's going to happen.
Okay, let's move on to DEF CON, or Mario?
DEF CON.
Thank you. This is a convention, as I mentioned, in Vegas.
Big hacker convention happens every year. It's a big deal, not just for hackers, but also for the government. And city,
right.
State, local
so
government.
So LA County is sending election experts to DEF CON. And what are they trying to figure out?
Yeah, so this year at DEF CON, for the first time, there's something called DEF CON Voting Village. And I just started following them on Twitter. I don't know if this is official or not, but it's at Voting Village DC. Basically, it's a like a workspace that gives hackers a chance to try and, as they would say, pwn, or, you know, hack into, to own, to gain access to, gain power over voting machines that are models that have been used in recent elections in the United States. So the idea here, according to Jeff Moss, a.k.a. Dark Tangent, the hacker who organizes this.
Dark Tangent.
Yeah, Dark Tangent.
That needs one of those.
Dark Tangent.
Thank you. Thank you.
He needs a black metal echo behind that. So hackers like him, it really bothers them when they hear misinformation in media. So when you get like a pundit on CNN or MSNBC waving their hands and getting people all riled up, but actually misrepresenting the vulnerabilities and the technical details, nothing peeves a hacker more than factually inaccurate information about security. So they're actually going to set up. These guys have been buying them off of eBay. So let's say voting machines that might have been used in Florida or
Kentucky or Ohio.
What
does that say about the
Ohio?
Security of our elections that we can get voting machines on eBay?
I mean, as long as they're not buying them from Russia, I'm not too concerned.
Who knows, right?
But anyway, they're going to set a bunch of these up. So L.A. County officials will be there. But I have also heard of other cities in other parts of California, not going to say who, developing election security research projects or looking out to security professionals, maybe just straight up hackers, to help them understand how their local voting systems might be vulnerable. It would be silly for our state not to also be engaged in that. So I would expect, as in every year, you'll see federal, state, and local government representatives at DEF CON. But I think this is going to be a particularly hot spot. If you go out there, by the way, a funny little DEF CON thing, the UPS stores and the copy and send documents stores in the area, they're not accepting little USB sticks or other tools that people can use to hack networks because they don't want to have the store taken down by hackers who are attending DEF CON.
I think we should just vote by Roomba. I mean, it already knows everything about us.
Hey, look, I think we should vote by deleting app. Like, you install each presidential candidate's app on your phone, and come, you know, day in November, everybody just deletes the ones that they don't like.
So you press hard and it gets all wiggly and
exactly.
Jenny Jordan, co-editor of BoingBoing.net, our regular web and tech commentator. Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline. Or should I say,
Madeline Brand.
Coming up, a guy who used AI technology designed originally for Barbie dolls to keep his dad alive. A dad bot, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. We engage with robots all the time. We talk to Siri, to Alexa. So why can't we use artificial intelligence to talk to real people? Real people who may have died. Well, that's what James Vlahos wondered as he watched his dad die of lung cancer last year. So he tinkered with some readily available AI technology and came up with something he calls a dad bot. His dad would live forever through artificial intelligence. That was the idea. James Vlahos wrote about the experience of making his dad bot in the current issue of Wired, and he joins me now. Welcome.
Hello.
Well, what gave you the initial idea for this dad bot?
It goes back to when I was working on a project to create an artificially intelligent version of Barbie. This was being done by Mattel and a company called Polestring. And I documented that process as a journalist. And in seeing it, it kind of gave me the seed of the idea that a children's toy wasn't the only thing that you could embody with a specific character and make interactive through these emerging authoring tools and artificial intelligence.
How difficult is it to use this technology?
It is harder than I thought it was going to be, and yet much easier than maybe you might think. You're starting from zero in the general public. The tool I used, Polestring, is sort of designed for someone like me who is not a computer coder by background, but rather a creative. It's for writers and authors and playwrights and comedians, and it's an environment where You can script one of these things and make an interactive character. It takes a lot of work. It's a very laborious process, but it's very magical when it starts to pay off.
Okay, so you began by first recording your dad talking about his memories for a long time, right?
Exactly, yeah. The project started early last year when I found out that my dad had been diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer and was going to die within a year or less. So in the family, we thought, you know, this is the time to finally do that oral history project we've been talking about. And I sat down with him and did a dozen sessions of an hour or more apiece. Just like, talk me through from your ancestors in Greece all the way through your childhood, college, meeting my mom, your hobbies. Just tell me your life story and I'm going to record it.
And here's a little snippet from one of those recordings.
The meeting of mom was at a rehearsal, an afternoon rehearsal. In the morning I'd been playing tennis. I came bounding down the stairs of the theater toward the stage saying, "Tennis, anyone?" And mom thought I was the biggest jerk in the world. So then we started talking on the telephone.
Okay, so you have all of these recordings. How does that then go into your dad bot?
So it's not AI magic like what people may have seen in a movie where you just feed it all the words and somehow automatically the computer creates this AI. Instead, it's a process of me combing through the 80,000 plus words in his oral history transcripts, pulling out all these pieces of dialogue, putting them into the computer program. That creates the things that he has to say. And I join that with just all my memories of things my dad liked to say, his particular expressions, his jokes, etc. That's kind of the first part. And that, in a way, is the easier part. The second part is then teaching him, they're called rules, but it's what he's listening for. So at any point in the conversation where he pauses and the person using the dad bot is going to write something back, he's trying to anticipate, like, what are all the things that a person might say at this point in the conversation so that he can then get to the next place. You know, he can respond appropriately and go to the next place that the conversation is going.
So actually thinking, in a way.
I guess so. I mean, it all depends on how you define thinking. And of course, neuroscientists are still trying to understand what happens when we think, and they don't fully understand that. But it's you can imagine it as sort of this giant branching tree of possible conversations that can go in many different ways. And sometimes it's guided by what the user is saying to the dad bot, but he also has an ability, like, he'll grab the reins. He'll say, "You know, I want to tell you about when I was in college and I was working for the Daily Cal newspaper." And he'll shoot off on that tangent.
And just to be clear, this is all in text form. This is an actual verbal communication like you would have with Siri.
Exactly. So to communicate with a dad bot, you'd pull out your phone, you'd fire up Facebook Messenger, you add the dad bot as a contact, and then I write him a message, he writes me one back. So that's by and large what he does, but then occasionally he does actually serve up audio clips so I can hear his voice, and in particular if he's singing a song or telling a joke.
Boys, the Cardinals, we damn. The Cardinals, we damn. Boys, the Cardinals, we damn.
It's, you know, it's just nice to hear his actual voice.
So you actually, pouring through these transcripts of your interviews with your dad, you really got to know his rhythms, like his speech rhythms. Not that you didn't know them before, but I guess you were really immersed in how he spoke and how he thought. And so doing this whole process, was it a way for you to get to know your dad better?
It was. I guess the difference between, you know, everything that I had up until then knowing him is I'm always just listening. So when I'm now actually trying to, you know, create his speech, you almost have to think a little bit like a playwright, like what's his motivation at this moment in the conversation? How would he respond, knowing my dad's personality? So in that sense, I had to really think about, like, when would he be likely to say something sarcastic? And when, knowing my dad, would he probably say something just simple and empathetic?
And just so that listeners understand, your dad was, from how you describe him in your article, a really extraordinary person. He was a polymath. He was an accomplished attorney. He was interested in musicals and grammar. He spoke many languages. He seemed like a really interesting person who had a lot of stories to tell. So you had a lot to go through when you were combing through these transcripts.
I did. Yeah, he's a person who he's hard to categorize because, you know, his career, he's a litigator and he represented public agencies. And so you kind of start picturing this kind of button down lawyer type. But then personally, you know, he was zany. He was kind of goofy and his imagination would go off in wild flights of fancy. And then he was a singer and he was interested in architecture and he was fluent in multiple languages. So, I mean, that one of the reasons I thought that he would be good for a bot is there was a lot to tell, and he had a personality that expressed itself well in words. He had a lot of signature sayings. His lexicon was distinctive. So I thought even in just sort of a simple chat interface, there's going to be essential him that will hopefully come through.
Well, like, what's one of his signature phrases?
Well, I'm trying to think of one that is suitable for radio.
Why? Were they kind of racy?
Yeah. Let me just think. Okay. If there was someone he didn't like, he wouldn't say that guy's a jerk. He would say he flames from all orifices. On a very hot day, he wouldn't just say it's very hot. He'd say it's hotter than a $4 fart. He liked those sort of old-fashioned words that, like, you'd find in a P.G. Wodehouse book or something, you know, like indubitably, or words you know and yet don't normally come up in conversation.
Okay, so for a family member or someone who knew him really well, he would have to respond that way, otherwise it wouldn't be authentic.
Yeah, that was... I had two main goals. One is just, this is going to be a bot that tells the oral history of his life in an interactive way, rather than being sort of a lecture or something that you read. And then second to that, you know, it wasn't to create a full AI replica of him, but it was to like do something that just had flashes of his fun, unpredictable, erudite personality. So a lot of that comes down to, yeah, just the little sayings or the precise ways that he would respond to something that, you know, I have a lifetime of experience of knowing.
There's a moment, we see this on a video you made for Wired, when you say, "I love you," to your dad bot. Let's listen to that.
Do you love me? Maybe that's not something you can talk about. I was disappointed in the dad bot when he didn't say he loved me back, and probably on two levels, like one, just the technological, like
dad bod. You're supposed to know that. You know how to respond to that. But yeah, it's fake, and yet I wanted to hear it.
So you programmed the dad bot, and it doesn't say I love you back when you say, do you love me?
I've fixed that since the time that segment was recorded. And the way he responds to that, because I do want it to be clear that it's a bot, it's not my dad, and just the distinction, and it's a bright line distinction. So the way he responds is, you know, I can't love you because I'm a bot, but I know that your real dad loved you very much.
Oh. Does it kind of creep you out, though, a little bit? Or do you have any moments where you think this is wrong, that I'm turning my dad into a machine, or that I'm keeping him alive artificially in this strange way, or that I'm creating emotional responses to something that doesn't really exist?
I sort of agonized over that question a lot before I started, and off and on during. And I think I've gotten to a place now where the dad bot is good enough that it can do some of what it was designed to do, share his history, have flashes of his personality, but it's just not nearly, it's not good enough to be creepy. And I've imagined, like, when this technology is much, much better, and it's paired with a video avatar that looks exactly like my real dad, like, absolutely, that does get to the zone of creepiness, and I can see that, but it's not there yet. And I think in how I've set him up, both in the experience you have in using the dad bot and how I relate to it, like, it is different than my dad. It is not my real dad, and I'm not deluded. To the extent that I have emotional reactions, it's when, like, it brings my real dad more vividly into my mind.
Like when you play, when the recording comes up, when you hear his voice.
Yeah, it's not that I'm looking at the cell phone and thinking, my dad is in there. It's, yeah, I'm looking into that place in my mind and seeing my dad's face and feeling closer to him.
Well, it's been great speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for talking to me.
That's James Vlahos. He's the author of Wired's August issue cover story called Dad Bot. And you can read the piece now online at wired.com. And Christian Bordahl is here now with some listener feedback.
Hello there. Hi. Such a fascinating story. It brings up so many questions, doesn't it?
It does.
I mean, you can imagine a time when artificial intelligence technology improves. You know, people pay to have AI versions of their loved ones created, mm-hmm. kind of blurring the finality of death altogether. I asked our listeners for their thoughts, and our frequent interlocutor, John G. Hill, says he wrote a short story about a businessman who was dead but living on in the artificial afterlife of a tech company, but his other dead friends started disappearing because their living relatives were dying off and they weren't around to sue the company to bring them back, and computer storage is expensive.
Oh my gosh.
And Tom Arredondo says, see the Black Mirror episode, Be
yes.
Right Back. Do you know that one?
I do.
That's the one about a woman who loses her boyfriend in a car crash, has him recreated in artificial intelligence, and she's not really satisfied with him, so she tells him to jump off a cliff.
There's also a great Roald Dahl short story, if I recall, about a husband who is just an eye, and he is kept alive by his wife. And then she does all these things he forbade her to do, like smoke, and the eye gets really angry. Anyway, that's it
for me. Love Roald Dahl.
Christian Bordahl, thank you so much. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.